politics defined by one man in the movement that he helped build. And I think we're at the very beginning of this movement.
I'm Michael Barbaro. That's Today on The Daily from The New York Times.
WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me tonight. Well, the big news today is that the U.S. Senate passed President Trump's sweeping policy bill. This legislation would seriously scale back spending on Medicaid. How are local rural health care providers getting ready for this change? Liam Mayo joins us in the second half of the program to break it down. Plus, we're going to take a trip into local history by exploring the D&H Canal with Patricio Rubio. But we start tonight with exclusive reporting on legislative impacts to local young farmers. New York State legislative session had big issues on the table for farmers in the region, and some of those issues were still sitting on the table when the legislative session wrapped last month. Some notable environmental bills failed to pass in the assembly. So what does this mean for New York's young farmers? Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar spoke with Brenda Gonzalez and Chris Nickel, co-owners of Finca Ceramos Farm in Calicoon Center and members of the local Young Farmers Coalition's chapters, about how state and federal policies could shape the future of farming in our area. And just a reminder, those federal policies are very much in flux at this hour.
So let's start with the bills that did pass and the bills that did not pass that the local Young Farmers chapters were monitoring this session.
Yeah, sure. I can start with a bill that definitely had some discussion among the young farmers that we're in community with. And it's actually a bill that arose from some discussions that I was able to take part in with the Northeast Organic Farming Association of New York. Some listeners may know Wes Gillingham of Wild Roots Farm and is on the Soil Health Subcommittee with me. And we have these conversations about the spreading of biosolids or sludge on fields. But one of the big risks that this practice involves is the introduction of PFAS or forever chemicals. And they can come into this biosludge from a few different ways, from human waste streams that are mixed into these biosludge applications, and from industrial uses, byproducts like pulp from paper mills, for instance, and chemicals that come out of that, that can be mixed into these sludge applications and have a high level of these PFAS chemicals. And to give you a sense of the scale, we don't have a clear sense of how widespread the practice of spreading this sludge directly on fields is in New York State. We know it happens in certain municipalities more than others, but we do know that major fertilizer and agribusiness companies are using these biosolids in the preparation of things as common as potting soil. If you get your Scott's mix at the Agway or Miracle-Gro, more and more likely it is these days that contains these biosolids. And so the bill that passed in the Senate but has yet to pass in the Assembly in New York State is a moratorium on this practice.
What about other bills that may have been on your radar?
So the Good Food Purchasing Bill was definitely on our radar. I have a background in education. I spent 15 years in schools. And something that we really hope to do as a business in the future is get our food into schools. The Good Food New York Bill was something that we were excited about because it really incentivizes public institutions to be able to spend more money on diverse farms who can provide the kinds of food that we're growing to the kinds of communities we want to serve. We grow a lot of culturally responsive produce and vegetables and herbs, and we want to make sure that the communities that really love those foods are getting those foods in as many places as possible, including in school settings. But right now, public institutions in the state are required to use a bidding process to procure food, and they have to go with the lowest bidder. And that creates a lot of incentive to reduce the price as much as possible, cut corners on labor, cut corners on safety, cut corners on environmental protections. so that you can get your bid in. So right now, for a farm like us, we're a second-year farm. We're really passionate about the community work that we're doing. We really believe in making sure that our labor practices are really solid and that they're sustainable and that our employees are able to do this work for as long as they want to. All of those considerations make it much more challenging for us to participate in any kind of bid process. We are essentially priced out if we want to have the kind of work environment and the kind of pay that makes our work sustainable.
Yeah. What I thought was what was interesting about the Good Food Bill this session was that I believe that it was actually passed through the legislature last year. It headed to Governor Hochul's desk in hopes of being signed, but then the governor actually vetoed it last December. Hochul said that one of the reasons why she decided not to sign it is she said that the way that the bill is written, it would lead to different standards across different jurisdictions, which she alleges would actually make it harder for local growers to secure contracts. I'm curious, like, what you have to say to those concerns. Is that necessarily true?
So I think our understanding of the veto is that it was pretty political. Generally, if the governor is going to veto a bill for principal reasons, she's probably going to do it a little earlier than the very end of December, which is the last moment for her to exercise that veto right. And I think you can look to the Farm Bureau's opposition to this bill to help explain Governor Hochul's veto. Mm. I think that is a Farm Bureau talking point. And frankly, I don't think it really holds water. And this year, I think we're very pleased to see that Senator Hinchey's bill passed with a veto-proof majority in the Senate. So 42 of the senators voted yes when it passed at the end of this session. And so if the assembly comes back, say, in the fall, they'll have another opportunity to pass this. And if they get a supermajority as well, then it can't be vetoed. And that would be really exciting.
Let's talk some bit about funding. President Trump's quote-unquote big, beautiful bill, it passed through the House of Representatives. It's now with the Senate. And it had, you know, initially included an estimated $230 billion in SNAP cuts over 10 years and would pass a significant amount of those SNAP cuts onto states specifically. I'm curious what some of these cuts that are being considered in the bill, what would that mean actually for the communities that you serve?
Yeah, that's a hard one. When we sat down to prepare for the end of our season last year after the elections, we anticipated this coming. And it was really concerning for us because 30% of our members last year were using SNAP benefits to buy their CSA share. Our goal this year was to have 40%. And our ultimate five-year plan goal is to have 50% of our members using SNAP benefits because everybody should be able to get quality, culturally responsive food regardless of what their income is. So we knew right away that we needed to start making moves, and we leveraged our community and our sliding scale to try to mitigate the cuts we were anticipating seeing. But it literally takes foods out of people's mouths. We have members who were SNAP members who we haven't heard from at all this season, and we suspect that it's because they don't think that they can afford to pay for a share this year. And that's hard. They were people we were seeing every single week, who we have relationships with, who we now don't have that connection point with anymore. I mean, food is medicine. We're talking about not just taking food out of people's mouths. We're talking about really impacting people's health.
Well, oh my goodness. So you're already seeing people who receive SNAP benefits or that you've been in community with already kind of pull back from the way they interact with you.
Yeah. I mean, they were not receiving enough by any means already when they were receiving their benefits. And I think everyone has been sort of wary that this was a possibility. And so, you know, a CSA is a commitment. It's a commitment for the season. And then I think there are people who don't want to make a commitment that they don't feel like they can fulfill at the start of the season if there's a chance that they're going to lose their benefits midway through.
You know, we talked about how this would impact the communities you serve. What about farmers themselves? How would these proposed cuts specifically impact young farmers and farm owners?
I think what we're seeing among the farming community, especially with young farmers, there are a lot of us who do this kind of more mission-aligned food access work. And a lot of us have been hit really hard by, even before the SNAP cuts that are looming large right now, cuts to food access programs like the Local Food Purchasing Assistance Program, LFPA, that the USDA was supposed to administer in a second tranche this summer, that is better known in New York as the New York Food for New York Families Program. It gets passed through the state and administered as under that name. And it allows food banks and food pantries to purchase our food directly using these funds and get it to their clients. And it's some of the best food that they ever get access to. We hear that time and time again. And, you know, as Brenda said, it's a right to have access to this kind of nutrient dense, preferably organically grown produce. And so these cuts are really impacting the way that we do business. We are trying to work with our local food pantry and food relief partners to help them find additional funding. I mean, philanthropy is really stretched tight right now. The Local Food for Schools program is another federal program that has been cut that a lot of farms were relying on to get food into schools. You know, you had food procurement managers in schools really grooving on getting access to our produce and getting it on the plate for kids of all ages. And to have that momentum sort of cut out from under us is a real shock, and it's a real blow. And I think as young farmers, we're trying to figure out what the strategy is in terms of advocating for the return of this funding and hopefully its increase, and figuring out where other sources of funding can be identified.
There's a lot that is up in the air right now, and I'm curious, what are you keeping an eye out for these next few months?
We're in a very tricky position. I think Brenda described it accurately in a conversation we had a little while ago as between a rock and a hard place. The feds are making good on these threats to massively cut funding, not just SNAP, but also Medicaid, which, you know, Brenda and I both rely on for our healthcare as young farmers. And the state has to figure out how to respond. I think one of the reasons that this legislative session felt so unfinished is because I think most legislators understand it to be so unfinished. You know, I worked in a state legislator's office for about 4 years myself, and I had never seen a session look quite like this one. And the time that I was working in government was during COVID. So that tells you something about the level of uncertainty that I think state lawmakers are facing down right now. And in conversations that we've had with state lawmakers, that we as advocates have had, that's become clear. They fully anticipate coming back to session in the fall once the dust has settled on the federal legislation and the impact of the cuts that we saw the administration make in the first 100 days. And they're going to have some tough questions. How hard can they push their federal colleagues to make good on the funding that was guaranteed and has been cut out from under them versus how much do they then need to dip into the New York Rainy Day Fund, which is about $33 billion. Mm. It's not chump change. And I think the calculus for legislators is how much suffering can the people of New York endure before New York just coughs up the money for New Yorkers?
Yeah, we're also really hopeful that they will, as they sort of grapple with this rock and a hard place that they're in, I hope that they will continue to talk to the community that they serve and really stay in touch with their partners in those communities to understand exactly sort of where the breaking points are for people. Because it's one thing to know the technical impact when you're up in Albany and you're on the floor arguing, but it's another thing to deal with the day-to-day reality. And so making sure that they're staying in touch with their communities, making sure that they're staying in touch with local advocates, making sure that they're really aware of the impact that these cuts are having as they sort of negotiate with the feds is going to be really important.
I've been chatting with Brenda Gonzalez and Chris Nickel from Finca Seremos Farm. Brenda and Chris, thank you so much for chatting today.
Thank you, Kim.
Thank you, Kimberly. Remember, in addition to her great reporting that you can hear on Radio Chatskill and here on the Local Edition, Kimberly Izar also hosts Farm and Country, which comes to you every Saturday morning at 10, only on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to the Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
It is the Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. Well, this afternoon, the U.S. Senate passed President Trump's signature domestic policy bill. It's not ready to be signed into law yet, but today's vote does set the stage for a final vote in the House on legislation that would cut trillions of dollars in taxes while also scaling back spending on food assistance programs, clean energy programs, and Medicaid. On Friday, Pennsylvania Secretary of Health Dr. Deborah Bogan held a press conference with Wayne Memorial Hospital in Honesdale. Other members of Governor Shapiro's administration were on hand, too. Their goal? To bring attention to the potential impacts of federal changes to Medicaid, from the impact on individuals' personal health care coverage to how the cuts may imperil an already strained rural health care system. Leah Mayo of the River Reporter broke down the numbers, the broader implications for our region, and who may be affected, even people who may not even be on Medicaid. He spoke to Tim Bruno live this morning on Radio Chatskill, starting with what PA officials had to say at Friday's press conference.
A lot of what they were there to do was to talk about some of the specific numbers they were seeing for how this will affect Pennsylvanians. They estimated that around 300,000 Pennsylvanians could lose their Medicaid coverage under the latest proposals coming out of Congress. We looked over it from the figures from New York, and over there, there was an estimate of around 1.5 million New Yorkers who could potentially lose their healthcare coverage statewide. Besides the Medicaid-specific impact, the Pennsylvania Insurance Commissioner, Michael Humphreys, estimated that around a further 270,000 Pennsylvanians who have individual insurance through the state's insurance marketplace, Penny, could lose that coverage. And that's coming from a couple of the other proposals that aren't Medicaid-specific that are in this bill. These are proposals to sort of allow some enhanced tax credits to expire, which would kick around 150,000 people off their insurance, estimated Humphreys, as well as changes in policies around enrollment in state, these affordable health insurance programs. So those were kind of the numbers they were seeing as far as the individual people who could be losing their health insurance because of the changes coming out of the federal government. But the broader picture they were there to talk about was the ripple effects that's going to have on rural healthcare. The CEO of Wayne Memorial Hospital, James Pettinato, he talked about the hospital's kind of current financial condition as being strained. He said that the hospital has been working to enhance services throughout its coverage area, but that even as it's been working to enhance its services and it's been getting a lot of support from local governments and from state government in order to do so, the area is still considered underserved. So even though they've been trying to improve their services, they could use with more support, not less. And that's sort of what the impact of these changes coming out of the federal government would be. It would be less support hitting the healthcare system in general, which is already strained, and then having an outsized effect on rural healthcare and rural hospitals.
Yeah, and in your reporting, the Wayne Memorial CEO, James Pettinato, said, quote, "The proposed budget cuts would likely force us over time to reduce services and continue to leave the most vulnerable population of patients at greater risk for disastrous health outcomes," end quote. That's the CEO of Wayne Memorial right here in our region. That's not some rhetoric coming out of Washington or some budget office somewhere or some cable news talking head. That's a real impact in our region.
Yeah, and he and other officials from Wayne Memorial went a little further into the individual impacts that they could see. He talked about how Wayne Memorial Hospital is one of the few hospitals in the area that's still, or few rural hospitals in the state that's still delivering babies. And he said that a lot of that is possible through Medicaid. He said that a lot of those babies are covered by medical insurance, and that a lot of those births are of high-risk patients who the health of the mother or the health of the child could be affected by not having this really skilled coverage available locally.
And these changes to Medicaid are not just impacting Northeast Pennsylvania. There were some changes announced earlier in June from Garnet Health talking about shrinking federal reimbursements as well as additional anticipated federal cuts to the Medicaid program that forced them to face some difficult decisions, as their CEO, Garnet Health CEO Jonathan Schiller, said in the River Reporter. So can you talk a little bit more about how these changes fit in the overall picture of those declining services at Garnet Health? And then if you knit those together regionally, just a real, like, I don't know, healthcare desert in some ways could be possible.
Yeah, all hospitals are going to be feeling these impacts. And this is part of a broader trend from Garnet Health of, over the past couple of years, even over the past decade or so, trying to reduce the amount of services it provides, or just trying to sort of right-size the hospital for the population that it currently sees. A couple of years ago, we talked with Garnet Health CEOs, and they said that the current sort of building that they're working out of was built in the 1970s when the region had a booming tourist population, and that based on the changes in population and based on the changes in medicine, that building and that the sort of services they're providing are kind of too much for the region, and they're trying to sort of create another building or trying to reduce the amount of services there. Whereas with Wayne Memorial, Pennato said that they're trying to boost services and this Medicaid cuts could sort of take the wind out of their sails. These cuts could sort of increase or add momentum to sort of a spiral of reducing services that is in some ways present over at Garnet Health. And the Medicaid changes kind of feed into that because of their outsized impact they're going to have on rural hospitals. And that was sort of one of the things that the Pennsylvania Department of Health employees were trying to emphasize at that Wayne Memorial press conference. One of the reasons they were at Wayne Memorial, a rural hospital, and the ripple effects they were talking about came in a couple of different ways. They said that a lot of patients, or an outsized number of patients in rural areas, are on Medicaid just because rural hospitals serve more vulnerable populations. Rural hospitals serve generally poorer populations. Hospitals in rural areas will lose more money, essentially, from Medicaid changes than hospitals in more urban areas will. And in addition to that, not only will it sort of lose the Medicaid funding from those patients who no longer have it, those patients are still going to need health care, and those patients, even if it's just emergency healthcare, those patients will still be coming to the hospital, but they'll be coming to the hospital in the back of an ambulance, and they'll be coming to the hospital in ways that the hospital can't really charge for. It's going to have to be uncompensated care, and that's going to not only strain the margins of these rural hospitals that in many cases are already very slim or in the negative. That uncompensated care will get spread to other paying patients in the form of higher insurance premiums or reduced services. So the message they were really trying to say is that these changes coming down from the federal level, like the big picture, the headline changes are the changes to Medicaid, but the healthcare system is called a healthcare system for a reason. It's kind of an interconnected thing. So $4 billion being taken out of the Medicaid budget, in addition to the other changes that they are proposing, will have this ripple effect that affects everyone's care, not just those people who rely on Medicaid.
Leah Mayo, great reporting here on the rural health care impact of these Medicaid cuts if they do go through. You can read that at riverreporter.com. Leah Mayo, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Tim Bruno. Well, we wrap up the show tonight with a trip into Sullivan County's past, along the Delaware and Hudson Canal. Radio Catskills' Patricio Rubio spoke with Fiona Feldman, Assistant Parks Director for Sullivan County, about the D&H Canal Interpretive Center in Summitville, including their lineup of free summer events like historical talks, guided walks, and more.
The D&H Canal Interpretive Center is located on 16 Bova Road in Summitville, New York, right off Route 209. It is filled with displays of the historic remains of the former Delaware and Hudson Canal, including a lock and wasteware itself. The center takes visitors on a journey to explore life on the canal, and through each phase of the canal's construction and its 70 years of operation. While exploring the interpretive center, you can learn about the lock system and enjoy the historic features on the site. You can even hike along the canal towpath from Summitville all the way to Worthboro. We have the linear trail is a 3.5 mile trail that it is flat and mostly straight, which makes it great for almost everyone to walk on. So whether you are a fanatic canal enthusiast or simply wonder why there are remnants of fancy stone walls in strange places along Route 209, the D&H Canal Interpretive Center will either solve some mysteries or fill in a few gaps about what people were up to in the area starting from the 1820s.
Yeah, I have to say personally, I think it's a really eye-opening place because I wasn't aware of it until recently. And it's amazing to see all the history and the way that Sullivan County bloomed from these D&H canals, which brought goods all the way from the city all the way up to further upstate. And Sullivan County was part of that canal system.
Yeah, it was amazing what the D&H canal did, bringing coal from Pennsylvania all the way to Kingston, which was then dispersed along the Hudson River, especially being to New York City. And the D&H Canal is what brought so much business and life to Sullivan County from having all of that, and really was a big part of the foundation in the area out here.
The summer started, so you have your summer hours. You're opening up every weekend on Fridays and Saturdays and Sundays. I see Fridays and Saturdays are 10 to 5 and Sundays are 12 p.m. to 5 p.m. But the big thing is you have a lot of events which are starting soon throughout the summer. So you want to talk about some of the highlights, some of the events we have this summer?
Yeah, for our 2025 events calendar, we were very excited to kick off our season with John Conway speaking the other day at the Interpretive Center. And upcoming, we have on Saturday, July 12th, we have a presentation by Bill Merchant. And on Saturday, August 16th, we have another presentation by Cliff Robinson. We are also participating in the Sullivan County Museum Weekend, where various museums throughout Sullivan County have free admissions and really focus on being able to share each other's location and information that they even exist in the first place. So even though admissions is free to the D&H Canal Interpretive Center all the time, we especially like promoting this weekend, which is on July 26th and 27th. And in the end of September and beginning of October, we also have Karen Barnes doing a guided history walk of the D&H Canal and O&W Trail Loop.
Fiona, yes. Before we go, is there anything else we have not touched on that you want folks to know about?
With the D&H Canal Interpretive Center, we also have an option for groups to come and tour together, whether it is a school group or some kind of club organization that wants to come together. We do schedule private tours with them as well.
We're talking to Sullivan County's Assistant Recreational Director about the Delaware and Hudson Canal Interpretive Center in Summerville, about the summer hours and also the events coming up this summer and fall. Fiona, thank you so much for talking to us. I do really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Patricio. And thank you for listening. That's it for the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. I'll be back here with you again tomorrow. Please, when you get a chance, go to WJFFradio.org. Make your donation to support this station as we are wondering what's going to happen with public radio funding in Washington, D.C. We're segueing to that point where we stop worrying so much about that and just start focusing on what we need, which is your help. Our summer fund drive is coming up and you can help us now at WJFFradio.org. That's WJFFradio.org. The Daily is next. This is Radio Catskill.
Support comes from Tavern on Main, a neighborhood bar and grill on Main Street in Jeffersonville, featuring local American fare, Saturday and Sunday brunch, and Thursday trivia nights. Menu and hours online at tavernonmainny.com.
Take a dive into the deep end, the ultimate rock music journey. Deep cuts, live tracks, and rare gems from rock, psychedelia, country, jazz, and blues. Experience the deep cuts on the deep end. Friday nights at 10, only on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville. From river to river, mountain to mountain, we are Radio Catskill.